Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Above Politics Show. I am Homer Fife.
And I am Martin Bain. And I guess you might have stayed up to watch the third presidential debate.
Sadly, yes I did.
And I have to suspect it wasn't the most exciting thing that you've done with your life for a while.
No, it really wasn't, Martin. However, this time I was actually pleased with the debate and with the way it turned out, contrary to what the mainstream media is telling you. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, hey, I was going to say, you know, because I mean, I suppose I look at it from what I see is everyone sort of saying that Obama came out ahead of that one and that the instant polling was turning around saying that John McCain really hadn't done a lot to reduce the gap that he's got.
Yeah, but Martin, there's no denying the fact that the mainstream media is Obama's love child. I mean, they're promoting him and pushing him into the office of president. So I think we had to watch the debate last night with open minds and make up our own minds instead of listening to all these pundits that are coming on and telling us what we should be seeing. And what I saw was, for the first time ever, John McCain appealed to his core conservative base, and I'm pleased with that. Instead of trying to be wishy-washy and come across as some kind of a moderate, he actually struck out with some good core conservative comments, and I was very pleased with that.
But do you think he's done enough?
No, I don't. I think that that's his biggest problem. The last poll that I read, he was 4 points down, which statistically is a dead heat, but still, we've got, 18-19% undecided, and he hasn't reached out to the undecided in the proper way, in my opinion. He is a conservative. He is a Republican candidate, and he needs to come across as a conservative Republican candidate. And instead, he's trying to be wishy-washy, and he's trying to relate to what are some of the names, moderate, progressives, the people that are in the middle. And I think that's a mistake. I think he needs to keep pounding on the core conservative values, reaching out to his core conservative base. And I think he would do a lot better. And I'm hoping to see more of that in the next 18 days.
Because certainly one of the things that has made headlines over here is this, this plumber called Joe.
Yeah. But you knew that was going to happen. I mean, he brings up poor old Plumber Joe, and now all of a sudden Plumber Joe is famous. I turned the television on last night fully expecting to see the Plumber Joe show, but I think that's kind of a mute issue. There, you know, the accusations are flying back and forth now that you're doing this and you're doing that, and none of it has anything to do with the issues, and it needs to just be dropped, and let's get back to the issue.
Absolutely, but I suppose it is interesting. I suppose one of the things I did see is that, you know, you're right, I would agree with you on that. I saw, you know, McCain was much more punchy. Now he was prepared to come out, and I think on a couple of occasions he may have sort of landed a blow. He didn't certainly land a knockout blow on Barack Obama, but he certainly put some hits into him, and I didn't see as many hits coming back the other way. But then it's interesting to see, you know, you hear what a Barack Obama was saying. You know, I get the impression that sometimes that he's working much more hard on being the statesman, whereas I think it maybe comes slightly more naturally to Senator McCain, whereas I think Barack Obama is having to work harder to project that I am a statesman image.
Great point, Martin. And I think that that's that is a relationship between the two candidates that needs to be looked at. The office of president is arguably, the president of the United States is arguably currently the most powerful position in the world. And you need to come across as a statesman. He has to interact with world leaders, and you have to look at the two and decide which one do you want representing us on the world court. And To me, anyway, McCain comes across as much more of the statesman. I agree. That's a great point.
Great point. And we also have a comment from an ATS member, Don White, who I got to record his views on the third presidential debate. So let's have a listen.
Hello, this is Don White, and we're on AboveTopSecret.com. I watched the last final debate on the last Wednesday. Both sides saw this debate as the best and last good chance to win the undecided voters. John McCain had been urged to go back to his national security credentials that had put him into the winner's spot during the primaries. But the urgency of the economic conditions would not allow that. Obama, on the other hand, is riding a 3-6% overall lead in the polls. To hold that lead, Obama figures he just has to be nice and look presidential. But this debate will be remembered for two things. The first, Joe the Plumber, and the second, the acorn, which is not, by the way, the oak tree seed. First on Joe Plumber. Actually, Joe's name is Samuel Joseph Wolzenbacher of Holland, Ohio, a suburb of Toledo. Last week, Obama was campaigning there, and Joe approached Obama and asked him a question, and a five-minute discussion ensued. The long and the short of it was that Mr. Wolzenbacher indicated he was contemplating starting a new business, and the higher tax would impede him in starting this business. Mr. Obama tried to explain that the tax would only apply on income he earned in excess of $250,000, taxable income, and that he was only raising the rate from the current 33% to 39%. So to make a long story short, on the $25,000 that Joe the Plumber wanted to talk about, the extra tax would be $1,500. Later, in an interview, Mr. Wurzelbacher told reporters outside his home that the constant references to him in the debate bothered me. I wished they had talked more about issues that are important to Americans, he said. I'm quoting this from the Sydney Morning Herald for October 18, which was forwarded to me by Expert 11, another ATS contributor. John McCain seized on that exchange as a way of proving Senator Obama was not in touch with Sarah Palin's favorite, Joe Sixpack. Senator Obama tried to dispatch those criticisms by pointing out that less than 2% of all small businesses in America net more than $250,000. And now for the second, ACORN. ACORN is an acronym for Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. Founded in Chicago in the mid-1960s, it specializes in getting people of color, the poor, and the dispossessed registered to vote. The Obama campaign paid ACORN $700,000 to canvass several neighborhoods in the Chicago area to get people registered. Obama has also represented ACORN as an attorney in the 1960s. This year, for example, ACORN registered 247,000 new voters in Ohio, 153,000 in Pennsylvania, and 151,000 in Florida. All of these are regarded as battleground and crucial states. Although there has been much criticism offered about the registration, some of them including Mickey Mouse, Batman, and all 63 of the Dallas Cowboy football players registered in Nevada, the fact is, in America, private corporations can engage in the business of voter registration. Their workers are usually paid on a per registration basis, which tempts people sometimes to go to some extremes. The point is, a fraudulent registration does not equal a fraudulent vote. What precinct voting official will let Mickey Mouse vote? Historically, Republicans have tried to raise obstacles to keep poor and blacks in America from voting. This is why there's a lot of that resentment against ACORN. Now, the deeper tragedy of this ACORN problem is the fact that on Thursday, the FBI was said to have made a leak concerning an investigation into ACORN, which is now being pushed by the McCain campaign. Leaking ongoing FBI investigations is a crime. Conclusion? After the debate, the CNN poll showed that the people believed, 56% of the people thought that Obama had won the debate, and 31% felt that McCain had won. In another poll taken the same time by CBS, of uncommitted voters, 53% felt Obama had won, and 22% thought McCain had won, which is Obama's largest majority of victory of any of the three debates. If I could, I'd like to digress a moment on the history of debates. The first televised presidential debate was in 1960. Vice President Nixon was running against Senator Kennedy. It was an interesting debate because Nixon refused to take the usual makeup, and as a consequence, he was seen sweating on the TV, and many people thought that he was sweating because he was not telling the truth, not realizing that the hot lights were causing the sweat. Kennedy, of course, had accepted the makeup before the debate. The League of Women Voters sponsored that debate and continued to sponsor all of the debates through 1992. In that year, Ross Perot ran as an independent, and the League of Women Voters had him on the debate. This was objected to by the two major parties. Although Ross Perot polled 19% of the popular vote, he did not get any electoral votes. Interestingly enough, Perot's 19% was half of what Bush Sr.'s 38% poll, and that left Clinton to win with 43% of the popular vote. So thereafter, the two political parties decided they would conduct the debates, and from 1996 onward, it's been a collection overseen by the two Democratic and Republican parties working together. I would like to see the League of Women Voters return to be the sponsor of the debates.
Thank you very much, Don. Appreciate that one. And I certainly, Homer and I, will be back to you as we get closer to the elections and then even for your views after the election. But
Martin, I'm actually starting to look forward to Don White's stuff. He's an excellent contributor.
Oh, I've got to say, we've used him in the past on the show, and I think we'll continue to use him. And just on that subject, if you want to be a special reporter on the show, we are looking for people from around the world. So initially, I am going to take out anybody from North America and Canada. I'm looking for members from outside North America who maybe want to record a piece maybe every month just on what's going on in their part of the world. And that's something I know Homer and I are very keen on. We're trying to broaden the spectrum of reports that we get on the show. We get something from Canada, we get something from the UK, we get plenty from the US. Hey, both Homer and I would like to see more from around the world. So if you're interested, you to us, email us, and then we can come back to you.
Now, Martin, along those same lines, I have currently, or I'm waiting on, and have been told that it's coming, a couple of interviews with some of our maybe potential foreign correspondents that you're looking for. They've responded back to me and told me that I can interview them, so I thought maybe I would talk to them first and we'll see how that goes.
Great. There you are. That just goes to prove it. Things are happening. And one of the things just following on from the presidential debate, and one of the interesting things I see is how successful Barack Obama's campaign has been with voter registration. I've even seen some TV and press reports in the UK about how effective his machine has been, and that, you know, he's getting a lot of people to register to vote. And you suppose you have to think, if you get someone registered, they're going to vote for you. So that is something I've certainly noticed outside of North America.
Yeah, but Martin, some of the people he's registering to vote are dead and have been dead for a long time. Take a look at the Acorn scandal. Now, Acorn, for those that are listening that aren't familiar, Acorn is the voting group that actually stands for the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. And you've heard all the hoopla over Obama and being a community organizer. Well, this is the organization that he worked for and worked with for all those years of community organization skills that he lauds all the time. But currently, Acorn's being investigated by the FBI for any number of things, not the least of which is registering 2,000 bogus voters just recently. Now, some of the names, and I'll just give you the short list, some of the names they registered was Leon Spinks, Frecky Magool, Fruto Boy Crispilla, and the list just keeps going on and on. It's been called, there was a King County prosecutor that made a comment on Acorn's criminal actions. It was an act of vandalism upon the voter poll. So we're talking about, I mean, how many Democrats are we going to get voting this year that truly don't exist? And some of the names they found were Mary Poppins, Dick Tracy. All of these people are now registered to vote Democrat. And like I said, currently there's an FBI investigation into this. So this could come back to bite Barack really hard when it comes out.
But will it bite him enough to drop any of the leads he's got? Because he may, if he's clever, be able to turn around and say, well, I don't countenance anything that's illegal in voter registration. I'm going to turn around and disown known all these people. You know, he could very quickly just distance himself from this one. But would we not expect to see maybe something similar from the Republican side? Surely the Republicans are also trying to get people to vote and registered to vote. Is it that the Republicans are just being more honest or upfront here, or is it that they're just better at hiding it?
Well, of course, that's always the comeback, and I expect to hear everything this year that we've heard in the past. The voting machines are going to, of course, be fraudulent, and whoever loses is going to throw all of this now, or throw all of this out for speculation. But getting back to your original point, is it going to make that big a difference? I think that it will make a small difference. I'm not a person that believes in the knockout punch coming at any point. I think that the Democrats have their core, the conservatives have their core, and you will not shake that core no matter what comes out. It could come out that Barack Obama is a shape-shifting reptile, and you still would have a core group of voters that are going to vote Democrat because they believe in the Democratic Party. But what it could do is bring a certain percentage of that 18% of undecided voters that we have over to one side or the other when they start to realize that groups like this Acorn are out to defraud the entire system. And I think that that's what needs to be talked about. But you're not going to see this on mainstream media. It's not going to be hyped as much as it should be because of the fact that the majority of the mainstream media is controlled by the Democratic Party.
And that's certainly something very interesting. And if you agree with us, you disagree with us, or you want to post your own ideas, you know what to do. Come and find the show thread and post away.
All right, folks, we're back, and this is Homer Fife, and Martin Baines here with us, and we have a guest. Our guest is Donald Palmisano. He is the author of the book On Leadership, Essential Principles for Success. And we're going to try to pick his brain in reference to the leadership qualities of both Barack Obama and John McCain. Donald, how are you?
Fine. Thank you for having me on the show.
We are pleased to have you here and looking forward to your comments. Now, can you give us a little bit of background on what caused you or what started you to writing this book and what motivated you, please?
Yes. I believe that the world has become a dangerous place, and it is essential that we identify true leaders and nurture potential leaders. I do not believe that you're born a leader. I believe that you can learn leadership. And I also wanted to pass on my thoughts to the next generation, especially to my grandchildren, my six grandchildren, and I dedicated this book to them.
Well, and that's outstanding. Now, you're talking about no one's born a true leader. So now my perception is, having served in the military, that that's a good place to learn leadership. Would you agree, or do you think there are other venues that this can come out?
I think the military is a wonderful incubator for leadership, and I stress that in the book. And I also have a picture of a pin that I was given that I wear proudly. The Joint Civilian Orientation Conference, where I was privileged to spend 9 days with the military with 59 other people selected by the Pentagon and go on maneuvers with the military, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, Special Forces. And I also served in the military. I am just impressed with the skill and the dedication and the courage of these people, men and women in the military. And it certainly is an incubator. I wear that pin proudly.
Okay, so, well, let's get to the meat of this thing then. In reference to McCain and Obama, now McCain has the military skills, obviously, having been in the military, and Obama espouses his community organizational skills. Can you give us your opinion in reference to those two candidates and their leadership skills?
Yes. In the book, I try to distinguish between success and leadership. I point out that success, one can be successful and not be a leader. But I list 20 essential elements of leadership. And what I encourage every reader of the book to do is not listen to the talking heads on TV or radio, but instead use your own brain, go through the criteria, and pick a candidate that you believe is a true leader. So let's take the presidential candidates. I'll take three of them, three of the 20, courage, communication, and decisiveness. So with Senator Obama, I conclude that his courage has not yet been demonstrated. Voting multiple Tom's present does not advance the concept of taking a courageous stand. Communications for Senator Obama, he is an excellent speaker who uses rhetorical devices well, just as President John Kennedy did. However, it is important to not just be for change, but to be specific as to what the change is. He promises a lot with generalities, but the specifics are not given in detail, nor are long-term consequences given. Let me give you an example. President Kennedy gave inspiring speeches with specifics, such as landing a man on the moon in the same decade. Decisiveness, again, for Senator Obama, again, the record of voting present multiple times rather than for or against is not a good sign. And I make the point in the book that people who don't take a stand on an issue or change their opinion depending on what audience they are talking to, I equate them to the folks in the Italian poet and writer Dante in the Divine Comedy, where he talks about the opportunists in the vestibule of hell. And so I believe we should identify those individuals and hold them accountable for those types of approaches. Now, Senator McCain, if you take the first of the three that I mentioned, a courage proven beyond a doubt. His prison of war activity demonstrates courage in the face of torture. To those who say, oh, being shot down in a fighter plane doesn't mean that you're a candidate or should be a candidate for president of the United States, but that's not the point. The point is, what did you do after you were shot down? How did you survive in the prison camp? How did you respond to torture? And he showed great courage, and his courage is proven beyond a doubt. He also has been a maverick in the Senate, and he will speak out. Doesn't matter what party is advancing a cause, if he believes it's good, he'll speak out on it, and he speaks his mind. Decisiveness, well, communication, I think Senator McCain, in a formal speech, he's not as polished as Senator Obama. He's not as good in front of a teleprompter. However, last night, for those folks who watched this on TV, or the people who watched the discussion at the Joseph Smith Memorial Dinner last night, I thought that Senator McCain, both of them did a very good job, but Senator McCain was the best. He's very clever, very witty, and I think he would have, if there had been more town hall meetings, that quality of his would have come out more. As far as decisiveness, Senator McCain gets high scores. He can make a decision, take the consequences of that decision. And the examples, again, the refusal to cooperate with the enemy in the prison of war, Hanoi Hilton, and his maverick stand on principle in the United States Senate. And let me just tell your listeners, if I may, Homer and Martin, that a leader is defined as a fully informed and decisive person with integrity who advances courageously toward a goal and is determined to overcome obstacles and setbacks along the way. And I always emphasize to every audience that you can't be a leader without courage and the ability to make a decision and act on it in a crisis when time does not allow waiting for all of the facts. And so with the current financial situation and with the threat of terrorism, the public must choose wisely using objective criteria.
Okay, and that's something we wanted to touch on, Donald, was – as far as the public is concerned, they need. How do you feel about the fact that one of the key elements of this election is the fact that the Iranian crisis, the current conflict in Iraq, the economic situation, potential strikes such as what happened during 9/11/01. Now, can you give us just a quick breakdown on your opinion of how each one of the candidates would handle such a crisis?
Well, I certainly believe that, in my view, and I tell every listener, every reader of the book to make your own, decision. By the way, your listeners can get more information on the book at the website onleadership.us. But there's no question in my mind that Senator McCain, an adversary of say, the United States, they would know that they're dealing with an individual who has courage and takes tough, principled stands. What concerns me is that if we get a president in the United States with inexperience, then what they will do is the people who are despots, the people who are totalitarian leaders, they will try to push and take chances to see how America will react. I think if Senator McCain is the president, they know how America will react, and he will not tolerate such activity. And so you need a strong leader, and the people who in who are in totalitarian regimes, I believe they certainly respect power and someone who is decisive. They look forward to dealing with someone who's not decisive, and they will just continue to make end runs around the position of the people in the free world.
And see, that's an excellent point, Donald. And it's something that I really hadn't considered. So what you're saying is the fact that the less experienced leader, if he is placed in that sort of position, could actually instigate more aggressive actions toward us.
Yes. I mean, it'll be an invitation for others to say, well, let's see what we can get away with. We don't know. Now, if they have an experienced leader with someone, it was like in the prison camp for Senator McCain and the wonderful Medal of Honor winner Stockdale, they knew they couldn't break these individuals, and they finally at one point said that they'll just die, and we want to use them, you know, down the road for negotiating. So they knew these people were not going to give up. And I think if you go back in history, when you have a leader who vacillates, when you have a leader who tries to we'll see what we can do and negotiate with this evil person. Let's give them something. All that does is encourage them to do more of the same of the bad. They do more of the same bad acts to get more. And you have to tell them that we want a world of liberty. We want a world. If you're going to do what you're going to do in your country, that may be your business. On the other hand, if you try to hurt our country, say, United States of America or our allies that we have a treaty with, then you will be dealt with promptly and appropriately.
One of the things that interests me is, if you think about what you've said about the two candidates, Donald, is how much does their vice presidential candidates also change their leadership qualities when you think of, say, I'm probably more interested here in Obama and Biden, because I suspect maybe some of the things that you're saying around his courage may be mitigated a little bit by Joe Biden.
Well, Senator Biden has been in the Senate many, many terms, and I think people have a pretty good idea of Senator Biden. Senator Biden, has a propensity to say some things that, when you check out the facts, are not accurate, and he sometimes says things that members of his party wish that he had not said. For instance, in the financial crisis, when it's astounding that someone who is in the United States Senate all these years and who studies these issues, as all the senators are supposed to do, would say that in the Great Depression in America in 1929, that President Roosevelt was the president, and he gave his fireside chat to everyone. Well, he wasn't the president at that time, and they said it was on TV. We didn't have TV at that time. And so when someone makes an error like that, it causes you to wonder, what else is he making an error about? It's like all the statements that are made in these two-minute interviews, five-minute interviews, or in these debates. I mean, people who are listening in the audience, they say, well, is that true? Wow, that sounds really something. It's like the different plans. Oh, you'll see that you'll end up with more taxes if you vote for the other candidate. Well, you need to investigate that as best you can yourself, because otherwise you don't know what to believe. People will just put out misinformation, and nobody will know what the real truth is. Part of the element, one of the elements of leadership is to do your homework. And my dad taught me that. When I didn't think I could make it in med school, when I first started medical school, he said, son, you're smart enough to be a doctor, but you have to remember three things. Do your homework, have courage, and don't give up. And one of the elements of the 20 for leadership is do your homework. And so you want people who are knowledgeable. I'm very critical of the way the people in Congress have acted for many years. Some of them are very good people, but I also make the point that instead of pledging their fortunes, as we see in our Declaration of Independence, where we pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, it appears to me that many in Congress are not pledging their fortunes, but rather working hard to increase their own. And I believe that the American people are disgusted and apathetic about the partisanship, patronage, and scandals that continue to stifle progress in Congress. I mean, recently with this financial crisis, for the people who chair these important committees, these Democratic folks who were chairing this and said there's no trouble with Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac and so on, and now they're trying to run away from those statements, that's ridiculous. And so the more government gets involved in the everyday affairs, the more we pay taxes and the worse economic freedoms are affected.
Donald, getting back to a quick point, you were talking about, at least it was my impression, the wishy-washy type of thing about not sticking to one issue and that sort of thing. But now, it was always my impression and what I learned in the Marine Corps and later on in life that a leader should be able to adapt. Now, how is it that we as the normal person can look at a candidate such as McCain and Obama and decide at what point is it not wishy-washy, at what point is it simply adapting to new information and changing your mind based on that information? And I think that it's confusing sometimes because of all the rhetoric that's being put out by the mainstream media.
That is an excellent point, and I make that point in the book, that you have to be persistent. On the other hand, if new information comes in, it doesn't mean that you keep doing the same thing over and over. You change your course of action, but you should have objective reasons for that, not because you're in front of a different audience and telling them what they want to hear to get their vote, but you actually now, if you know that, let's say you're searching for someone. Let me use an example. You're searching for a lost child who fell down a mine shaft or something. You're searching for a child, and everybody's there trying to help out. You keep digging and digging, and everybody's saying, we'll get to this child, we'll get to this child. Well, if somebody brings you good information that says there's another shaft over a half a mile away, and we have evidence the child went in that hole, you don't keep digging in the same hole. You said we have new information, so you send a team over there immediately, and the child turns out is in the second area. And so you do it with objective information. But on the other hand, if you know for sure that the child is down there, you don't give up.
Absolutely. I think that's a very sensible point. One of the other things I'm interested in, there's many people who are saying, you know, because of McCain's age that he may not last a term. So be interested to see what your views are on the leadership qualities of Sarah Palin.
Yes. Well, first of all, let me address the first point about age. Our longevity, the experts who are doing the research in this field, our longevity comes from our mother's mitochondrial DNA. In other words, the potential for longevity comes from your mother and not your father. Research done at the medical school in Oklahoma, a leading researcher there. And so Senator McCain's mother is 94, 95 years of age, and you see her on the campaign trail or at some event, and her mind is sharp. So that's very good for him. But certainly, you have to look at the presidential candidate, because the presidential candidate, if there's a disaster or an illness that incapacitates the vice president moves up into the position of president. And so the leadership qualities, I think Governor Palin, the majority of people, tremendous ratings in her state of Alaska, that she is a good governor. She's demonstrated that she can get more money to the people and have more of a free enterprise type approach rather than more of a government control approach. I think she's been hit hard by many in the media and many who want to knock out the McCain-Palin ticket by focusing on her. And I think she's been treated in many ways, in many situations, very unfairly. But, you know, people need to look at her and they need to compare her to Joe Biden. If anything should happen to Senator Obama. We have no indication that anyone has any health problems. Senator McCain did have a problem with a melanoma on several occasions in the past, but his doctors say that he's clear of that now and there's no evidence of recurrence. So I believe you have to, you know, just look at that. But I would it would be my view that if Senator Obama becomes the president or Senator McCain, that they would serve out their term.
Okay. Just looking around at the crop of, say, world leaders currently and, say, maybe in the last 10 years, is there somebody outside of North America potentially who you think typifies what you see as being a good leader?
Well, I thought Margaret Thatcher was a good leader. I think the new leader in France. I hesitate to go through because I don't know. I did not focus on leaders in other countries, and I hesitate to make a comment unless I have all of the facts in front of me where I can, you know, go through my own list. I try to just go more to the generic discussion in this book of leadership, the qualities. And I go back in history. I go to George Washington, the person I consider the gold standard for leadership. I go through present-day individuals. I interviewed people that I consider leaders and asked them what do they think are the leadership qualities that make a true leader. For instance, I interviewed Melinda French Gates of the Gates Foundation, the wife of Bill Gates, and she gave an example of Nelson Mandela as her ideal embodiment of leadership because of his courage, imprisonment, when in prison for many years, and also his ability to forgive and bring the nation together and get rid of apartheid. So there are many different views in the book as to what constitutes leadership, but I think when you distill it down, when you say this person is a true leader, if you'll then look at the criteria in the book, I think that person you will find will embody most of those particular principles. You need a person of integrity, a person who can communicate the message. I'll give you examples of what leadership is not. During Hurricane Katrina in my hometown of New Orleans, that was the first chapter is called The Antithesis of Leadership. And I thought the mayor failed, absolutely failed, and I thought the governor failed. I thought FEMA failed at the federal level. And they knew what could happen to New Orleans. I worked at Hurricane in 1965, Hurricane Betsy, and we knew lessons from that. I was a resident at Charity Hospital, a surgical resident at Charity Hospital in New Orleans. And we also had, in 2004, we also had a mock hurricane, a practice hurricane, so to speak, put on by the federal, the state, and the local government. And they said, these are the things we need to do. And those things were not done when Hurricane Katrina came. So there's an example of people who did not look at their homework. They had the homework in front of them. They didn't study their homework. They didn't apply it. And they couldn't make decisions in a time of crisis. Throughout the book, I give example after example of people who made decisions in a crisis. They didn't ask anybody's permission, but they did the right thing. They didn't let bureaucratic rules get in the way. I give an example of when I was in the military, a B-52 crash, and it was a flame. The tail gunner was trapped. The flames were racing toward him. They were trying to get him out, and a young airman jumped in a fire truck and drove it at full speed right into the fuselage and knocked him free. Another 2 minutes or so, the man would have been dead. But this young man realized that somebody had to get that fuselage broken in half and get him away from the flames. That's an example of a young leader, and that type of individual should be nurtured because they can make decisions in a crisis.
Now, Donald, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm getting ready to here, okay?
Go right ahead.
I think that some of the things that we might get in reaction to our discussion here is, let me just preface it this way. Hitler would be considered an outstanding leader. So how is it that we look at the two candidates, or any candidate for that matter, and elect them solely on their leadership ability when in historically speaking, many of our leaders have wound up being megalomaniacs or psychotics, or, you know, however you want to term it. So how is it we differentiate someone? Because we both know that absolute power corrupts absolutely. So how is it that we differentiate the difference between a Hitler-like leader, or like Hitler, I'm sorry, and a leader like George Washington, who you have stated is your base for a great leader?
Well, I make that point in the book. First of all, Hitler was not a great leader. Okay, so you can put that and underline that and put that bold. Hitler was an evil person, a tyrant, a dictator. I say that leaders make decisions that make events happen. Obviously, there's more to the definition of leadership, as tyrants do the same, and they are not leaders. And so in order to be a leader, my definition of leadership, you have to be a person of integrity. You have to be a person who does things for the good of everybody else and not for themselves. A true leader does not rule other people or act as the name leader if they keep the followers there by force. You see that in dictatorships. If you don't go along with what the person in charge says, you will be killed or your family will be killed. Those are not leaders. There are other words in the English language for those people. Tyrants, dictators, evil people, call them what you want. They're the people in power at the moment, but they're not true leaders. And so that's the first point I wanted to make. The second point, I want to make sure I'm answering all of your questions. True leaders, and I've interviewed a number of other leaders, and one of them points out that people willingly follow a true leader because they believe in the mission. They believe that this person will put themselves at risk rather than say, you go charge over there, and I'll stay back here where it's safe. No, a true leader will be at the front of the people and take the risk, and take whether it's the risk of being shot by a bullet or the political fallout, whatever it is. They're not people who sit at a board and say, oh, I don't want to vote. Well, why don't you want to vote? Do you have a conflict? Is this close conflict? No, I just don't want to vote on this. No, you can't do that. You can't undertake your fiduciary responsibility and not vote. So, but ask me what I haven't answered about your question.
I think you've answered most questions. Certainly, I think we're getting close to wrapping up here, Donald, and we certainly appreciate your time, and it's been a really interesting interview. Do you think that the Democrats and the Republicans have actually put forward what you would regard as their best candidates for president?
Watching and listening to the results of this election, I think it's a fascinating election. It's an important time in the history of the world, and it's very important for America to make the right choice and get true leadership.
And certainly, I think we've spoken a lot about just the two candidates. What about some of the other candidates? I mean, maybe particularly thinking here of, you know, you've got the Independence Party, you've got the Green Party, you've got some other leaders, maybe even Ron Paul. And I was just curious what you thought about Ron Paul.
Well, I think Dr. Ron Paul is a very principled individual, and I think he has predicted a lot of the things that are happening right now, because you just can't keep spending money and say, well, we'll take more money out of the Treasury and do these other things. The money doesn't come from England. It doesn't come from Russia. It doesn't come, from these other places. This money, the more money you print up, the more you bring on inflation and so on. And Ron Paul has pointed out that tax people less. So I think he's on target as far as the principle he espouses. But what happens in politics, if you're not in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, your chances of getting, of being the person, it's almost as though your vote is wasted. And so what we have to do is get everybody to realize that we must put courageous people forward. But and not pander for the vote by changing their opinion depending on what audience they are in front of.
Okay.
I think, Ralph Nader, I think that's, again, someone I've had the opportunity to debate Mr. Nader over the years a couple of times on in forums and on TV shows. But I think those are, you know, essentially wasted votes unless you want to put a protest vote out there. And you have to look at the what I encourage people to do is make your own decision on how you want to live your life and try to understand. There was a book written many years ago, Henry Hazlitt wrote, it's called Economics in One Lesson. It's probably 50 years old. And it says, Economics in One Lesson, I can tell you the book in one sentence. It says you have to consider not just the short-term consequences, but the long-term consequences of your action. And so that's what Congress needs to understand. What I had originally in the first draft of my book, but as the book went through the editing process, the book was made shorter, but I say that we would have people up there. We would know who the people are we should keep in office if we had every senator and every representative vote on what they are about to they would be given a test on what they're about to vote on. If they don't get 70% on the test, then their vote doesn't count. I also think that when America goes to war and there are indications to go to war, a perfect example is what happened on December 7th, 1941, when Japan attacked America at Pearl Harbor. We ought to have clear indications when we go to war and how we should apply those equally to every place, every country. If we have a treaty with the United Kingdom, we have a treaty with Canada, and they are attacked, then we honor our treaty commitments. But when we do go to war, I think what we ought to do is embed some of the senators and representatives, maybe five from the Senate and a proportional number from the House, and rotate them through the front lines for about 6 weeks and then send them back. And then it would get an idea of what the troops really need rather than saying, oh, I don't know if I can believe you, General. That suspends my reality belief. I'm paraphrasing that. But, no, they would know because they had been on the front lines, and they would know that the troops need protection and against these devices that blow up the trucks and so on.
That would be an interesting thing to see, not only in the U.S., but I'd also like to maybe take that a little bit further around the world and maybe send some other politicians to the front lines on as well. We want to thank you very much for your time. I just want to, as Homer put you on the spot a little bit, Donald, I'm going to take the liberty of doing the same thing. So based on the two candidates, which one's going to get your vote?
Well, again, I'm going to vote for Senator McCain. Other people that I know and respect, they're going to vote for Senator Obama. And again, what I tell people is that you ought to vote your own conscience based on doing your homework. And I give you 20 criteria to go down, and you will make some mistakes when you vote sometimes. But learn from that. You will say 2 years later, I made a mistake voting for that candidate. Well, why did you make a mistake? Learn from that, correct that, so you don't keep doing the same thing over and over. In other words, you change based on new information. The point that we had discussed earlier, that Homer brought up. And so, I'm going to vote for Senator McCain. I think he's someone that I would want at the negotiating table if we have a terrorist encounter and other countries are harboring terrorists. He's the man, I think, that would best protect our interests.
Okay, well, just before you go, if people want to know more, is there a website they can go to?
Yes, sir. It's onleadership.us, onleadership.us.
Okay, well, we will make sure that that goes on the show thread for this show. Donald, I certainly want to thank you for giving us some time and talking to us about the leadership qualities. I've certainly thought about how I'm going to use my vote in the UK next time round, and some of the points you've raised makes me think about, you know, that my vote should be much more earned by candidates rather than just maybe sort of just pandering a lot to just what the media say. So I certainly want to thank you very much for that.
Donald, I'd like to thank you as well. This was like Martin said, this has opened my eyes, and I really want to thank you for this interview.
Oh, thank you, Homer. And I look forward to another encounter with you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And the next segment in the show is a UK roundup from Neff & Moore, which is slightly longer than usual. So over to you, Neff.
Hi, guys. This is Neff with an extended UK roundup.
As is the case with the rest of the world, the UK is feeling the effects of the credit crunch, and the ensuing market chaos has forced the British government to act to prop up the system. Gordon Brown is feeling the pressure of the credit crunch, particularly acutely, not least because in the years leading up to this crisis, he was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the man supposedly with his finger on the pulse of the UK and international economies, and who was fully aware of the way the banking system was operating. And while Brown can put his hands up and say that he is not directly responsible for the UK side of the crisis, as he was not privy to the internal workings of the banks, he cannot duck the issue that the government in the UK could have cut some of the problems off earlier and pushed for tightened banking regulations to restrict aggressive lending and credit. On the 13th of October, the government announced it would pump £37 billion, which is approximately $64 million, into three major UK banks, Royal Bank of Scotland, HBOS and Lloyds TSB. This follows on from the partial nationalisation of one of the UK's biggest mortgage lenders, Bradford & Bingley, and the Northern Rock affair last year, where a major bank was almost left to collapse entirely before very late state intervention. Overall, the total cost to the UK taxpayer, who ultimately funds these loans, is in the region of £50 billion at the moment. Not only that, but Brown is looking at a situation where the government may have to come to the aid of approximately 116 local authorities and private savers across the country who have had money frozen and potentially lost in the Icelandic banking system following the collapse of that country's major savings institution, Landisbank. Potentially, £858 million of public sector money is at risk, and that total rises to up to £4 billion, including private savings. Even more embarrassing for the government is that its own audit commission, the body tasked with overseeing financial regulations, may have lost £10 million. In an unprecedented step, Brown utilised laws usually used to combat terrorist funding to freeze certain Icelandic accounts in the UK in order to retrieve money from them where possible. That action has caused a major diplomatic storm with Iceland, and the effect of the action remains unclear as negotiations with Icelandic authorities are still underway. Adding to the financial gloom is the news that the UK's rate of inflation has reached its highest spike in 16 years, house sales have reached a 16-year low, and the yearly increase in unemployed people has just been revealed as the highest in 17 years. There are some positive steps happening, however. The drop in oil prices has led to fuel costs reducing across the UK, with the government openly leaning on companies to lower prices and pass their savings on to customers. Brown has been meeting with world leaders to push various bailout packages being brought forward, and the government is giving assurances that individual savings and private investment funds are protected and can be funded. And the weirdest thing of all is that right now, at this time, Brown is uniquely qualified to give opinions on and actually understand the machinations of the financial system, and he is desperate not to make further mistakes to tarnish his image. Whether or not he can pull the proverbial rabbit out of his hat and head off the current crisis remains to be seen. But just for once, he may actually be the right man, in the right place, at the right time. And it's very unusual for me to say that. That's all from me. So back to you guys in the studio.
Great work as usual, Neff. Thank you very much. And to wrap the show will be another rant from Homer Fife. It seems his last one was well received, so you're getting another one. So on behalf of Homer Fife, I am Martin Bain, and we will see you next time on the Above Politics show.
This is Homer Fife. I want to rant for you for a minute about the economy. And I want to clear something up from the start. It may just be my perception because I live here in the United States, but it seems to me that the citizens of the United States are the ones that are complaining most about the economy. And why would I mention that? What do I see that's wrong with that? Well, it's kind of simple. People that are living in what is termed below the poverty line in the United States simply have a better standard of living than the average citizen in the rest of the world. Now, before any of you get your hackles up, I know that some places in the world have as well a standard of living as we do here in the United States, perhaps even better. But if you take on average, people in the world live somewhat below the standard of living here in the United States. Now, make no mistake about it, I'm all about success. I mean, I'm a capitalist after all, and I believe in the free market. But I haven't always been that way. And but what did I do? I wanted to change my lot in life, so I struggled. I struggled, and I have succeeded. Exactly what anyone who is listening to this rant can do. On the other hand, what did I not do? Well, I did not just sit around and complain about things being bad. I did not ask for the government to give me a handout. I knew that my own personal destiny was in my own hands. That if I didn't improve my lot in life, no one was going to come along and improve it for me. So what am I saying? I'm saying that if you're struggling, that if you personally are struggling, stop complaining. Get out and make a success of yourself. If your business is struggling, stop complaining and improve your business. Regardless of what the economy is currently undergoing, if you have a business that is offering a product and that product is attractive to your consumers, the economy is not going to have anything to do with whether you sell or don't sell your product. And the economy is not that bad. Now, the $700 billion bailout gave us a downturn recently in the stock market. It scared the heck out of investors. It scared me. But look at the market now. Yesterday, up over 400 points. And yes, some of you are going to point to the recent volatility of the market as an indication of a bad economy. I'm going to suggest to you, however, that you take into account that some amount of fluctuation is good for the market, and therefore good for the economy. The market is a direct indicator of our economic health, after all. Now, I'm not going to sit here and argue with you that prices aren't up. But there are many reasons for the prices being up. And did any of you out there truly expect prices to remain static? Think about it. If prices remain static, we have a static economy. The economy either grows or it dies. There is no in-between with the economy. So we can't expect prices to remain static, and we shouldn't. Now, looking at some different things that may cause the increase of prices, and look, I don't like paying more for bread and milk than you do out there. But you have to understand several things. Look at the minimum wage. We've just recently increased minimum wage for the second or is it the third time. Now, common sense dictates that if you force an employer to pay his employees more, he's going to have to, by default, ask more for whatever product or service that he offers just to stay in business. Also, I don't know whether any of you are familiar or not, but the unions, most major unions, I know that the United Auto Workers and the United Mine Workers both, have a contractual agreement to keep their pay levels, the pay levels of their constituents, at a certain value point above the stated minimum wage. And what that gives you is an across-the-board artificial inflation that's induced by the government as it pertains to prices, simply by raising the minimum wage. That's just one of many factors that are caused the increase in prices. But salaries have gone up, and before anyone gets started, yes, there are personal horror stories out there all across the nation, and I understand that. Some people are closing businesses down, but you know what? Other people are starting businesses up, and the housing market's in the tank right now. But it's in the tank for sellers, but is it in the tank for buyers? Think about that. What I'm hearing now is this is a perfect time to buy. We have a very low interest rate. We have tons of houses on the market. And while I'm going to get flamed for this because I don't personally believe in taking advantage of another person's misfortune, foreclosed homes are a great buy. They're just a great buy. And the more money that we get into the economy by people buying foreclosed homes, if it's already foreclosed on, I don't know how it's taking advantage of someone else's misfortune. But I'm sure some of you will see it that way. But the more money that we inject into the economy, the better the economy is going to be. These foreclosed homes are going to go to someone. Why not go to some of us that realize the advantage of having an investment property? So all of you out there, all of you listening to my voice, with your new cars, with your DVD players, with your high-definition TVs, your cable, your internet connection, stop complaining about the economy. The economy is identical to the concept behind Above Top Secret. It's member-driven. If you don't do something about the economy, then it will not improve. I don't care how many trillions of dollars the United States government, the government of Great Britain, or Germany, I don't care how many trillions of dollars are injected into the economy. If we, as consumers, if we, as small business owners, if we, as citizens of the world, don't step up and improve the economy ourselves through our work, our struggling. If we don't do that, then the economic situation will never change. If you are unhappy with your current economic situation, that's the only possible solution. This is Homer Fife, and hey, that's just how I see it.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.